This is SciPod, the podcast of New Scientist magazine.
Welcome to SciPod, the weekly podcast of New Scientist magazine and your audio guide to the latest news in science and technology. Hello, I'm Bill Oxley. This week on the April 7th edition of SciPod, Walk of Ages. Did the first Americans leave footprints? Copy wrongs. The subtle connection between disease and duplicate genes. And from the slopes of the Himalayas to the underground subculture of the African mole rat, we hit the highs and the lows in this week's science news. But first, 13,000 years ago, a group of Stone Age hunters crossed the Bering Land Bridge from Siberia into Alaska. Those hunters were thought to be the first humans to reach the Western Hemisphere. But that theory has been challenged in recent years thanks to new evidence that suggests an earlier population of humans was already settled in the New World. Now, a team of scientists say they've found human footprints that push back the arrival date of the first Americans by tens of thousands of years. And in doing so, they've stepped into one heck of a debate. Science journalist Robert Adler has been tracking this story, and New Scientist's Ivan Semenek caught up with him this week.
Robert, you've been to the site in question. Could you set the scene for us? Where is it exactly in Mexico, and what does this site look like?
Well, it's near Puebla, Mexico, which is not that far from Mexico City. So when you're at the site, you can see the volcano Popocatépetl looming in the distance. It's very, very beautiful. The site is high desert, so if you like rocks and solitude, it's a place that you'd enjoy. If you don't like sort of cactus and dry, sandy area, you might not.
Now, I guess you've seen the footprints that are at the center of this story. How much like footprints do they really look?
They look a lot like footprints to me. Of course, I'm not an expert and haven't studied them using any sort of scientific method. But the team that has worked on this has. They're all about the same size as you'd expect from human footprints. I think that's one of the significant things that I noticed is if they were just produced by erosion, for example, then you'd expect there to be little ones, human-sized ones, and maybe huge ones. But anything that looks like a footprint at this site happens to be the size of human footprints. Most of them are just single prints, but there are some that look like trails. And you can see a left foot and a right foot and a left foot and a right foot. And those trails, on the whole, seem to parallel what the geologists have determined was the ancient shoreline of the lake that existed at that time.
Now, can you recount for us exactly how these footprints were discovered and who made the discovery?
Well, this team, the lead scientist is Sylvia Gonzalez. She is at Liverpool John Moores University in England. And she and her colleagues were surveying what's called the Valsequillo Basin, which is a pretty extensive basin in this high desert. And the reason they were surveying this was because there have been a lot of interesting archaeological finds made there since the 1960s, but the dating of this area has always caused confusion. And so they had driven up to this apron of volcanic ash, hardened volcanic ash. And Sylvia got out of their vehicle. Her two colleagues set off to look at the rocks on either side of this apron. And she took a step or two and saw footprints. And as she said, it was like a thunderbolt in her head.
Now, ancient footprints, of course, would be a big discovery, possibly a controversial discovery, no matter where on Earth they were found. But in this case, it's not just the existence of the footprints, it's their age, as you say, that's really ignited the controversy. So what does the Gonzalez team say about the age of the footprints?
Well, they put a lot of work using several different top-notch dating laboratories and a whole bunch of different methods into dating the rocks above the footprints and the volcanic ash in which the footprints appear. And more recently, the sedimentary rocks below the footprints. There were two key findings. One group was able to date some snail shells. These are little spiral-shaped snail shells from the layer that's geologically above the footprint layer. And they got that using a type of radiocarbon dating. They were able to date that to 38,000 plus or minus 500 years ago. Then another team, also at Oxford, was able to use a different technique and date some little chips of baked clay, usually orange-colored bits of baked clay, that are found throughout the volcanic ash layer where the footprints are. And this method called optically stimulated luminescence isn't as precise, so it gave a date of 38,000 plus or minus several thousand years, but that date corroborated the date from the layer above the footprint.
Right, and if we take these dates at face value, what kind of impact would that have on our understanding of the peopling of the Americas?
Well, if you call the footprints 40,000 years old, which seems very secure from this team's point of view, it's about almost 30,000 years older than the accepted oldest humans in the Americas.
Now, as you explain in your New Scientist story, Sylvia Gonzalez and her colleagues are facing some pretty tough criticism. Can you explain what those critics are saying? What kind of counter evidence they're putting forward to all of this?
Well, the chief critic who's emerged is a gentleman named Paul Rennie, who's a dating specialist at the University of California, Berkeley. And he happened to be working at a site very close to the site where they were working. This is a site called Wayat Laco, and it's really just, 500 yards from the site, the footprint site. So when he learned from Sylvia Gonzalez and her colleagues about this, he made a visit to the site. He looked at the marks that they were interpreting as footprints, and he announced in a commentary that was quoted in Nature, I've seen them up close and personal, and I don't think they're footprints. Hmm. So he immediately questioned whether they were footprints or not. He also took some samples of this layer of hardened volcanic ash in which the footprints are imprinted. And he's a leading specialist in what's called the argon-argon dating method. He took these samples back to his lab in Berkeley. He tested 9 of them and got an age of 1.3 million years. So he's saying, and has said also in Nature, that either these footprints are shockingly old, 1.3 million years old, or they're not footprints.
So is this enough to sink Gonzalez, or does her group have a response?
Her group doesn't think they're sunk at all. They have several responses, one of which is that, first, they're convinced these are footprints. They applied a set of criteria that were worked out after Mary Leakey found very, very old footprints in Tanzania. And so there's a set of criteria for evaluating whether marks are human footprints that have existed for many years. They used those criteria and concluded that something like 164 of the marks that they found were definitely human footprints. So they're secure. They feel they're secure on that. Then the key dating question comes down to dating this layer of hardened volcanic ash. Their dates come from these orange chunks of what they've identified as baked lake sediments that are mixed throughout this ash layer. They're visible to the naked eye. And they dated those using a technique called optically stimulated luminescence, OSL, to roughly 40,000 years. Rennie dated these little black beads that make up most of this volcanic ash. They're the size of pellet gun pellets or smaller. And he dated those and got his 1.3 million years. They also, this team led by Sylvia Gonzalez, also tried to date those same black beads, but they got such a wide range of ages from 1.3 to 4.6 million that they concluded that there had been some sort of mixing of different age rocks into the magma that produced this ash. And so they concluded that you can't date the rock layer from these little black beads, but instead, the youngest rock that's mixed in must be the age of the ash.
I see. So with one group looking at the sediment, the other group looking at the darker material, which maybe is mixed in from some older rock, there's still a bit of a loophole for those footprints to step through, I guess. Clearly this has all the makings of a real scientific row. What do you think it will take to resolve the debate?
I think that this may need for an independent team. to come in and do some very hard work and corroborate everybody's dating and give an independent read on this, because right now the two teams seem to be deadlocked and sort of butting heads.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for taking us through this story. I think it's likely that we'll be talking about this again, and it'll be interesting to see what the next chapter brings for the footprints.
You're really welcome, and I agree. This isn't the last chapter of the story.
Great. Thanks very much.
Science journalist Robert Adler spoke to us from Santa Rosa, California. To find out more, check out Robert Adler's feature story about the Mexican footprints. And to find that, well, you just have to walk on over to this week's issue of New Scientist magazine.
Because you're curious about the latest in science and technology news, we bring you SciPod.
Now, here's Jeffrey Whittle with this week's science news.
Tibet is known as the roof of the world, a high-rise plateau that towers over its neighbors. Now it seems Tibet's lofty status may be a newer development than geologists once thought. Researchers at Florida State University in Tallahassee collected fossil horse and rhino teeth from sediments located in southern Tibet. The sediment was dated at 7 million years old. A carbon isotope analysis of the teeth suggests the ancient animals dined on species of grasses that no longer grow among the chilly slopes of the Himalayas, but which are typical of warm climates. The likely explanation is that this part of Tibet was sitting at a lower altitude 7 million years ago and was therefore much warmer than it is today. That means Tibet's current height is the result of a fairly recent growth spurt. It also means that India's monsoon season, which is closely linked to airflow around the Himalayas, is an equally recent phenomenon. Chaos theory, the branch of physics that deals with complex and unpredictable systems, could help monitor the effectiveness of treatment for Parkinson's disease. A team of Russian and Canadian researchers asked 16 patients with Parkinson's disease to hold their index fingers in the path of a laser beam. The beam was then used to measure the frequency of their tremors using techniques that were originally developed to analyze earthquake vibrations. The team monitored the distinct progression of Parkinson's symptoms. They found that patients in the early stages of the disease had more chaotic tremors, while in advanced cases the tremors became more regular. In those cases, it was possible to spot the effectiveness of medications, which caused the tremors to become more chaotic again. And finally, being fat and lazy may not seem like the ideal way to attract a mate, but it may be if you're a mole rat. Reporting in the journal Nature, zoologists studying the Damaraland mole rat of southern Africa have discovered that mole rat colonies are split into two distinct castes. One group is hardworking and industrious, performing more than 95% of the total work of the colony. Meanwhile, members of the other group are the mole rat equivalents of couch potatoes. They do virtually no work at all and spend their time building up their fat stores. Yet, when the rainy season comes and the soil is moist and soft, it's the lazy mole rats that suddenly get busy digging burrows to strike out and reproduce, possibly mating with mole rats from other colonies or even founding colonies of their own. Although these patterns are familiar among ants and bees, mole rats are the only mammals known to breed cooperatively in this way, with some colony members devoting their lives to helping others reproduce.
We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of SciPod, and we'd love to know what you think of our podcast. If you've got a comment or suggestion, please drop us a line. Just email your feedback to podcasts@newscientist.com. And now, back to our show.
There's no doubt that your health depends, at least in part, on your genes. But increasingly, it turns out that it's not only which genes you have, but how many. These days, researchers are finding entire stretches of the human genome where big chunks of DNA are copied and duplicated. And they're beginning to suspect that these gene copies play a role in conditions as diverse as Parkinson's disease and autism. Dr. Stephen Shearer is director of the Center for Applied Genomics in Toronto, Canada. His latest research has taken him deep into the mysterious domain of duplicate genes.
Dr. Shearer, perhaps we could start with a bit of a tour of the human genome. I mean, we all share sort of the same basic genome, but between individuals there are differences. Can you point out some of those differences and what kinds of things you're looking at?
Yeah, so historically, some 30, 40 years ago, we discovered that there were, in some cases, large structural changes that one could see under the microscope that varied between individuals in the population, and these are translocations and large deletions. They tend to be in about 0.4 to 0.6% of the population, and they tend to be very large, so greater than 3 million base pairs or so. And then on the very other end of the spectrum are the single nucleotide changes, the so-called single nucleotide polymorphisms, or SNPs. These are one nucleotide differences between individual chromosomes. And we know now from many studies that there's probably some 3 million SNPs in any genome and perhaps some 10 million in the world population. But then there's been this gray zone between the SNPs and the large structural chromosome changes that we didn't really have a good grasp on because the technology wasn't available to do genome-wide scans. And that's really what we're talking about in this large-scale copy number variation or copy gene number variation.
So we're talking about entire sections of DNA which are duplicated, you know, once or twice or many times. What kinds of copies are you seeing?
We're seeing the average size of these copy number variations probably in the order of 300,000 nucleotides or so, or 300 kilobases. Just to put it in context, the average gene size in the genome is about 50,000. So on average, we may see some 5 or 6 genes of either copy number increase or decrease per variant. In some cases, the variant itself could be present in many, many copies. So instead of just the average 2 in your genome, which you get one from mom, one from dad, you may see, say, 6 copies or so. And in some cases, they may be located right beside each other on the chromosome, but in some cases, they may be on different chromosomes. So the complexity can be quite great. And so these type of characteristics are not really fully characterized yet. We're trying to understand that better now. Now that we have the initial description of the phenomenon itself.
Now, when we start talking about duplication of genes and the links to disease, I guess there's one obvious example that comes to mind, which is Down syndrome, where you have an entire chromosome extra, and that's certainly been known for some time. But it sounds like what we're talking about here is a little bit more subtle. So what sort of links could there be to disease, and how are you tracing those links?
Well, if one goes back and looks actually at what's known about the known disease genes, about 30% or so of the mutations are actually deletions of DNA that are larger than a nucleotide, so not a point mutation, for example. So one would expect that, in fact, these types of copy number deletions changes or also copy number increases will be associated with disease. And there's several diseases I can think of, you know, I can name 50 or so off the top of my head that we know arise due to copy number decreases or increases at specific sites along the genome. And since the papers were published in 2004 describing this global distribution of copy number variants, there's been a handful of examples where these new discoveries of submicroscopic variations have been associated with disease. So clearly this will be a major contributing factor to disease. It's just a matter now of doing the studies.
I know some of your research involves looking at a connection between some of these copy number variations and autism. Can you tell me more about what you're finding in that case?
Right. So we hypothesized probably about 5 years ago that perhaps chromosome rearrangements may be a major contributing factor to the development of autism. And the rationale for this was that microscopically you see a comparatively high percentage of chromosome rearrangements. It's something on the order of 7 to 9%, depending on the study. So we thought maybe, well, now that we have this technology that allows us to scan at the submicroscopic level, perhaps we'll find more of these types of copy number increases or decreases associated with disease. So one of the experiments we've been doing is to assess using a gene chip-based scanning approach, a very high resolution, the genomes of autistic individuals versus controls. And the data is still quite preliminary, but certainly we see perhaps 10% or so of the cases we've been looking at have de novo or new changes, new mutations that are not seen in the parents. So one way to explain that is, in fact, these changes may be actually associated with the disease, but in doing these studies, one has to be very, very careful because autism is what we call a common complex disease. There are probably many different contributing genes, and the complexity may be quite great. So we have to further our studies in many controls, including parental controls and population controls. But the data is quite exciting because it allows us really to kind of look closely within the genomes of these individuals in a way we couldn't do just a few years ago.
Now, given that complexity, you know, where might this take us in terms of treatment for these conditions? I mean, if there's a genetic link, you might be able to explore that, but could it actually lead to something more like a treatment in the future?
I think initially the studies will have most impact at the diagnostic level. Many diagnostic companies now, DNA-based diagnostic companies, are looking at this copy number variation information. And often when one identifies the associated mutation, be it a deletion in this case or, say, a duplication, one can use that information quite effectively in family planning. So I think that will be the immediate benefit to autistic families or other diseases that one might be studying, with the longer-term goal of getting to the actual disease-causing gene and then using that information, as I said earlier, to help design proper therapeutics.
It certainly does sound exciting, and I wonder if we could just finish off, if you could give us a snapshot of the field. You know, it does feel, as you speak, that we are entering a new chapter in the exploration of the human genome. I hesitate to use the cliche, brave new world, but of course we... You know, there are all kinds of implications by having this kind of a high-resolution view of the genome. Do you have a sense that this is now moving rapidly? I mean, there hasn't been as much, since the Human Genome Project, there hasn't been as much high-profile news about this. But, what's your sense of how quickly things are moving in this area?
Well, you know, a lot is moving very, very quickly. A lot's going to happen in the next year because people are just now getting these technologies set up in their labs and having access to them. It usually takes 2 years after an initial discovery that you'll see an impact in, you know, across the world in laboratories. And I think going forward we'll see the incorporation of an analysis of the copy number variation of the genome, in addition to, say, a SNP-based linkage or association study, to provide a much better understanding of the architecture of the genome so we can attempt to make the proper associations with disease. So that's coming, and it's really been driven by the new technologies that are available just in the last, I would say, 18 months or so. So it is a brave new world, certainly in the design of genetic studies, I think.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much, Dr. Shearer, for giving us a bit of a glimpse into that world.
Thank you.
We reached Dr. Stephen Shearer at the Hospital for Sick Children in Toronto. He's one of the researchers New Scientist profiled this week in a feature article that explores the science of duplicate genes.
Subscribe to New Scientist magazine, and every week you'll enjoy a comprehensive roundup of the latest science and technology news, along with a listing of the best science jobs from around the world. Subscribe today, and you'll save 40% off our annual price, and get unlimited free access to the entire content of NewScientist.com. To take advantage of this offer, just visit NewScientist.com/2504. That's NewScientist.com/2504 for this week's best ideas delivered right to your door.
Well, that just about wraps up this week's edition of SciPod, but it's only the beginning of what you can find in the April 8th edition of New Scientist magazine. Also in this week's issue, the elixir of life. We all need water to survive, but now it turns out that water has a quantum secret, which goes much deeper than quenching your thirst. Newton's curse. Researchers pore over Sir Isaac Newton's old notebooks and try to recreate his experiments with alchemy. And Lost World. Computer simulations suggest that a planet once existed between Mars and Jupiter. But if so, where did it go? All this, plus lots more science and technology news, features, and opinion. Remember, only New Scientist brings you the week's best ideas. I'm Bill Oxley. Join us next week and find out what's new on SciPod.
Mission Control. SciPod transmission concluded.